This one lay. Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. Iran's foreign ministry says the interim government... Iran's foreign ministry has actually had a reaction to what the IAEA has said in terms of the interim agreement that it has reached. This came based on the fact that Iran, given the fact that it's an NPT member, it did not pose, obviously, any type of endangerment. However, based on the cooperation that Iran has given, there was an interim agreement that was reached. But it has not only been a victim of nuclear deal gone wrong due to the U.S. pullout. The Israeli regime, the possessor of nuclear warheads, though undeclared, accuses it of racing to get the bomb. Let me bring in our correspondent, Homa Lesgi, from Vienna first to find out how this interim agreement came into place. Homa, at this point, tell us more, if you can, elaborate more on what happened.
Yes, Pavel. Today, of course, we had the beginning of the IAEA Board of Governors session, and today Rafael Mariano Grossi informed the board and issued a separate report describing to them what happened in Iran, saying that during his visit that took only a few hours, I think 10 hours in all when he was in Tehran, he'd reached an arrangement with Iran that allows the agency to continue monitoring and verifying Iran's activities. So basically what this means is that the IAEA's monitoring equipment, the cameras, the surveillance equipment are still going to be recording the data. However, this data, as I said before, is going to remain in Iran under the joint seals of Iran and the IAEA. And he said that this is basically a stopgap measure, or this is an effort to create a bridge between now and the time when the JCPOA will hopefully be back in place. But if the talks to resume the JCPOA do not lead anywhere, if we don't have a JCPOA in place, then what will happen? This is something that the sides have not actually discussed yet, and they're waiting to see how developments evolve from this stage on. If indeed the JCPOA does not survive, this means that the agency will not have any of the access that it had under the JCPOA, and Iran has said before, at least under the previous government, that it will keep this data or destroy this data and not give this data to the agency. So what the agency wants at this stage is to be able to have a continuity of knowledge when it comes to Iran's activities. So in the case that the JCPOA is back in place, it can reconstruct the picture of Iran's activities. And I also noticed that you were referring there to the issue of Israel. I'd also like to just quickly mention here that, in fact, today in the press conference, there was a question put to Mr. Grossi concerning the actions against Iran's nuclear program, sabotage attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities, for instance, in a facility in the city of Karaj, or the assassination of Iranian scientists. And we know that a lot of media reports have said that this is the work of the Israeli regime. One of the reporters is asking Mr. Grossi if he is going to condemn these kinds of attacks that are being perpetrated against the nuclear facilities of an IAEA member state that is under IAEA supervision. And he still did not mention Israel, just saying in very broad terms that the agency as an international organization condemns all acts of violence. And this is something that Iran, the Iranian ambassador here, has time and again talked about in his addresses to the board, saying that the agency has a duty to officially and systematically condemn Israel for its sabotage attacks against the Iranian nuclear facilities, and also complain and about the fact that Israel is not an NPT member state, is not actually a part of the NPT, does not have any obligations, worldwide. It has nuclear weapons and is considered a threat in the Middle East. The agency refuses to even discuss this issue or to try and persuade the Israeli regime to accept some of these commitments. So it does have a nuclear weapons program on the one side, and on the other side, as a nuclear weapons power in the Middle East, it does not have any restrictions. It does not have to report to the IAEA about its activities, and it's actually being rewarded. So this is also a position that's been expressed time and again by the Iranian ambassador here.
Thank you very much for that, Homolesky. We appreciate it. Homolesky there from Vienna. Let me introduce our guest, writer and political analyst John White, joins us from Edinburgh. John White, welcome.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Actually, Daniel Lazar also joins us. And at this point, we're going to have John White to get the first question. John White, you know, when we take a look at this, you take a look at this interim agreement that was announced between the IAEA and Iran. It's a temporary agreement, but at the same time, Iran, looking at the situation where the U.S. pulled out of a deal, and Iran, that's an empty member, allowing the IAEA, obviously, inspections, one of the strictest inspection regimes that the IAEA has had on any country, comes out and makes this deal together. Why is it that Iran is being accused and portrayed in a negative light when it comes to the way that it's conducted itself, and yet the cooperation is not reflected in this?
Well, thanks for having me. This is the IAEA to continue monitoring its nuclear activities and its development of its nuclear energy, given where we are, that the Americans sabotaged the JCPOA under the Trump administration, given that Iran, as your correspondent eloquently laid out, is not a member of the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, but it has something in the region of 300 nuclear warheads developed with the connivance and the aid of the West, Western powers, and it gives lie to the fatuous claim of Western ideologues that the West stands for the rules-based international order and international law, and countries like Iran are rogue states, when in fact it's the absolute opposite which is true, which is Israel is given sanction by the West to behave like a rogue state, and Iran is a victim of the West's hypocrisy. This is grotesque hypocrisy, which yet again confirms that the problem that ails our world is not a lack of democracy within states, but a lack of democracy between states.
All right, let's bring in at this point Daniel Lazar from New York. He's a journalist and author. Daniel Lazar, welcome. You know, there might be some viewers out there who are not familiar with, for example, what the NPT is. If you don't mind, generally speaking, explaining to us what that is, and at the same time, tell us why it isn't Israel a member of the NPT, if you can.
The Non-Proliferation Treaty was an agreement, I forget when it was negotiated, but it was part of a deal that would allow the core nuclear states to hold onto their weapons. And in return for no new states coming on board, you know, attaining nuclear capability, the core nuclear states agreed to work towards a mutual disarmament of their own nuclear weapons. So there was it was a tit for tat. There was a disarmament among the core nuclear states and an agreement among the non-nuclear states not to try to attain nuclear status. So so the grand strategy was to therefore deliberately, carefully, gradually ratchet down the international nuclear arms race. And Israel, thanks to the U.S., was granted a giant exception. It was allowed to accumulate nuclear weapons with no international oversight, and it's not a member of the NPT. So therefore, it claims the right to go it alone. And in fact, when the UN Security Council gave its blessings to the JCPOA, the 2015 nuclear accord with Iran, the resolution actually included a plank that said there would be no reference, no criticism of Israel's anomalous status. It didn't quite say that outright, but that was clearly implicit in the language of the resolution. And the JCPOA and Iran, in agreeing to the JCPOA, tacitly agreed to this anomalous status on the part of Israel. So Iran's rough treatment by the U.S. ever since 2018, when Donald Trump walked out of the JCPOA for no good reason, even though the international authorities agreed that Iran was faithfully abiding by the terms of the agreement. So since then, Iran has sort of suffered a double rebuff. It's been punished for both abiding by the terms of the JCPOA and also by tacitly agreeing to the continuation of Israel's anomalous status. And so for those concessions, Iran has gotten a great big fist in its face, delivered by the United States. It's really a complete outrage.
Indeed, there was a presser that Said Khatibzadeh, John White, the foreign ministry spokesperson, when asked the question as to why the International Atomic Energy Agency and European countries show no sensitivity towards non-peaceful nuclear program of Israel. This was his response. Unfortunately, the West follows a double and very shameful standard, as a result of which it not only refrains from putting pressure on Israel to join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and to disarm, but also provides it with everything at its disposal, that is, to encourage it to violate the international system and pose a permanent threat to the region and the world. His words, do you agree with it?
Absolutely, in every particular. The only thing I would say with double standard is putting it lightly. This is a crime, because it's a crime of the threat of nuclear mushroom hanging over Iran, hanging over other countries that refuse to bow to the West and bow to Israel as a Western ally in the region. And the fact that Israel is allowed to continue to stockpile something in the region, as I said earlier, 300 warheads, that's a dagger pointed at the heart of Iran. And no government that's self-right-thinking can allow that dagger to continue to point at its heart. That's a viable security threat on a daily basis, and that's something that the Iranian government must take seriously. There is no restraint on Israel. There's no constraints by which it abides. It has the West dangling by a string over residual guilt over the Holocaust. That's what this is all about. All roads lead to the Holocaust when it comes to Israel being allowed to arrogate this power to itself, its exceptionalist status. But guess what? The Iranians were not responsible for the Holocaust, which killed 6 million Jews in Europe. Neither were the Palestinians, neither was the Arab and Muslim world entire. Yet they're having to pay the price. And it's a long time that the West was held up to account, and that Israel was held to the same standard that the Iranians are being held to. Iran's been nailed on the cross of Western guilt over the Holocaust, and it's a grotesque hypocrisy.
We're going to break this open a little bit, but let's go for a flashback here, Daniel Lazar, if I may, and see if you remember who said the following. Tehran will be on the brink of a nuclear weapon in less than a year. Iran is 90% along the path of having sufficient weapons-grade material. And the person who said this had something in his hand that was in the form of a caricature drawing. Do you recall who that person is?
Yes, I do. That was Benjamin Netanyahu, in his famous speech before the UN General Assembly.
And what year was it? Do you remember?
Pardon? Yeah, and he held up a crude drawing of a nuclear bomb It was really a comical performance. But the funny thing is that not only does Israel revel in its nuclear monopoly in the Middle East, but it regularly threatens violence against Iran for doing anything, making the slightest sign of challenging that monopoly. And now that the JCPOA, the 2015 nuclear accord, to me it's clearly a dead letter. But now that it's a dead letter, I think that Israel is more prone to take military action against Iran, and for the chances of some kind of military conflict in the Persian Gulf are rising significantly.
The problem here, and I bring this up, John White, I mean, this is first of all going back to 9 years ago, but how is it that Israel is taken seriously when its credibility is in question? Time and again, Netanyahu has said, I'm disclosing these secrets about Iran's weaponization of nuclear program, or whatever terminologies he uses. And the IAEA has, in some cases, actually said, we have new information coming from Israel. We have to look at it. We have to analyze it. And my point being is, why is it that then, when Israel has come out and said these falsifications, that is still being taken seriously?
Well, Israel is seen as a strategic asset by the West, particularly the United States and the region, even though it's actually a liability, and it's increasingly become so. You mentioned the Benjamin Netanyahu circus at the UN General Assembly. I think it may have been 2014. I think it was during the Obama administration where he was trying to bounce Obama into not going forward with the JCPOA at that time. But Israel is taken seriously by Western governments, but it's not taken seriously increasingly by Western populations. Support for the Palestinians, for example, has never been higher in the West. Anytime there's another bout of Israeli violence against the Palestinians in Gaza, the demonstrations are bigger than they've ever been before. I think it's commonly held, the consensus is among people of conscience and consciousness in the West, that Israel is a rogue state, is an apartheid state, and is a serial violator of international law. So this is a real geopolitical disjuncture that exists in the West now between what the governments want and what they think is in their interest, and the populations at large who are appalled at support for this rogue state, which is an oppressor of the Palestinians, which does not abide by international law, and which sees itself enjoying an exalted status because of the support it receives from capitals, Washington, London, Paris, and Bonn, etc.
Yeah, and what happens, Daniel Azar, is you're having Naftali Bennett, for example, coming out recently, fresh out of his trip from the White House, saying there needs to be a rapid international action against Iran's enrichment surge. Or you have Israel's Minister for Military Affairs just days ago threatening Iran, prepared to strike Iran, he said. Even the U.S. President Joe Biden recently said there are options. You know, that famous use of that word, quote, options on Iran. And here it is, you know, making these threats against Iran. When Iran is cooperating with IAEA, and the most recent cooperation is what happened with the interim agreement reached the Iran, again, with the IAEA in terms of what are monitoring arrangements that they made. Again, Iran showing goodwill. So you can see where I'm going with this. Why is it that Iran is being shown as the bad guy?
Because Iran is being set up for a mugging. I mean, essentially, Israel is very consciously pushing Iran into a corner where whatever it does is wrong, and whatever it does, therefore, merits an ever more militaristic response by Israel. So it's being set up for some kind of assault. We don't know when it's going to happen. You know, the timing is indecipherable. But clearly, Israel thinks it has Iran checkmated. And that over some point, you know, it'll continually press its advantage and therefore use its military leverage and economic leverage to really push Iran more and more into a corner.
Okay, John White, a recommendation that came from one of the administrations of Iran, which is still something that Iran holds out there for it to be done, and that is the recommendation of a Middle East region, which we refer to as the West Asia region, to be free of nuclear weapons. I mean, this is something that Iran wants to actively pursue, if possible. Why is it then, John White, are you with us?
Yes.
Okay, great.
Yes.
I mean, this sounds like a great plan. I mean, it's been proposed many times, but it's been boycotted by the U.S. and naturally, of course, by Israel. It's something that Iran would like to pursue. Why is this not being received positively and warmly?
Because neither the West or Israel are interested in peace and stability. They're interested in power and domination. And that's a great lacuna in all these negotiations. This is not about arriving at a place of peace and stability to replace the instability and the conflict that has been waged in that region over decades. It's about maintaining this power and balance that Israel enjoys because it has nuclear weapons and Iran does not have nuclear weapons. And that's what this is all about. And in many respects, these negotiations have been a charade.
Okay, unfortunately, we lost John White. We do apologize for that. So, Daniel Lazar, here we are. We are on the brink of perhaps a deal or not. And at this point, if we take a look at the way that things are moving forward with the new Iranian administration and the way that the U.S. is reacting, it's still up in the air whether this is going to happen or not. What is your take, if you can briefly tell us, as to where this is going to be going and then what's going to happen in turn if there is not going to be a nuclear deal?
I mean, I'm very pessimistic. I don't see any option for a nuclear deal. I've been pessimistic from the start. I mean, when Joe Biden announced in I think it was July 2020 that he wanted to re-enter the JCPOA, he attached to it conditions that Iran could not possibly meet, and conditions were completely extraneous to the logic of the agreement. They dealt with non-nuclear issues like support for Hezbollah, Iran's own non-nuclear ballistic missile program, etc. And of course, Biden accused Iran of fostering terrorism, which is an absolute outrage. He also accused Iran of violating human rights, and obviously Iran is not guilt-free in that regard, but it ignores the massive violations on the part of Israel and Saudi Arabia, America's two major partners in the region. I can't see any way by which the JCPOA will be reactivated during a Biden administration. And if it's not reactivated, then I think that Israel's strategy, with backing from the U.S., is to place Iran at the disadvantage, to ratchet up the pressure steadily. And if Iran tries to increase its nuclear refinement processes, I think that Israel may very well respond with a major military strike.
Okay, we're gonna.
And I'm sorry. That's what I think this is all leading to.
No problem. Thank you. We're just fresh out of time. I want to thank you, though. That's Daniel Lazar, journalist and author, talking to us from New York. Many thanks. Writer and political analyst John White, thank you, who spoke to us from Edinburgh. And we had our correspondent, Homa Leski, who spoke to us from Vienna. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. From Mikhail Vitali, it's goodbye until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses, and then we'll be back, so stay with us.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
أَمْ تَسْأَلُهُمْ خَرْجًا فَخَرَاجُ رَبِّكَ خَيْرٌ
Or do you, O Muhammad, ask them for payment? But the reward of your Lord is best, and He is the best of providers.
وَإِنَّكَ لَتَدْعُوهُمْ إِلَىٰ صِرَاطٍ مُسْتَقِيمٍ
And indeed, you invite them to a straight path.
أَمْ تَسْأَلُهُمْ خَرْجًا فَخَرَاجُ رَبِّكَ خَيْرٌ وَهُوَ خَيْرُ الرَّازِقِينَ Or is it that you ask them a recompense, but the recompense of your Lord is the best, He is the best of the sustainers. وَإِنَّكَ لَتَدْعُوهُمْ إِلَىٰ صِرَاطٍ مُسْتَقِيمٍ And verily you call them unto the straight path. The Arabic word خَرَاج means a fixed amount determined as a tax or rent on land. But its root, the word kharj, means that which is consumed. So, in this verse, the Almighty Allah is telling His Prophet the fact that if a spiritual leader asks people for material reward and recompense for his call, not only would he provide an excuse for some pretext seekers to avoid him because of not having the financial resources, but the most important thing is that he could also be accused of using his call to the truth as a business to earn a living. So one must not ask for money to propagate religion. Allah is the only one who guarantees the sustenance of those who do that. This holy verse implies that the excuse of their escape from the truth might be the fact that the Holy Prophet asked them a recompense from them for his call, while the recompense of Allah would certainly be better, and He is the best for giving sustenance. And furthermore, what does this human being have to give to another? Is not all sustenance in the hands of Allah, the Provider, the All-Powerful? You may remember the previous verses that showed the excuses that these blind-hearted people advanced to avoid yielding to the truth. How they justified their opposition with only unfounded pretexts. Now, the Holy Quran here illustrates the sincerity of the Prophet ﷺ and the truth of his call. It is that he does not seek any material gain from the people. If he did so, it would have provided one more excuse for the obstinate unbelievers to use against him. So, the verse interestingly says, أَمْ تَسْأَلُهُمْ خَرْجًا فَخَرَاجُ رَبِّكَ خَيْرٌ Is it that you ask them a recompense, which of course you don't, فَخَرَاجُ رَبِّكَ خَيْرٌ But the recompense of your Lord is the best, and you as the Prophet know that, وَهُوَ خَيْرُ الرَّازِقِينَ And He is
the best of sustainers.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran. By Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
As a general conclusion, the next verse says, "And verily you call them unto the straight path." وَإِنَّكَ لَتَدْعُوهُمْ إِلَى صِرَاطٍ مُسْتَقِيمٍ. It is the straight way whose signs are obvious for those who do not blind themselves. And of course, soon it will be evident to those who are not minute enough. Now, the question is, what is meant by the straight way in this verse? وَإِنَّكَ لَتَدْعُوهُمْ إِلَى صِرَاطٍ مُسْتَقِيمٍ. We know that the straight way is the shortest distance between two points and is the only way, but there are endless divergent paths to its left and right. In some narrations, the straight way has been interpreted to mean the guardianship of Imam Ali alayhi salam, but as we have said many times, such narrations are the statements of some of the clear examples of the original meaning, and they can never contrast the existence of other examples. So, when we see in some narrations that they have introduced the straight way as the Holy Quran itself, or as belief in Allah, or belief in resurrection, or sometimes they introduce holy war and justice as the straight path, they are the examples, the clearest examples of the meaning of the straight way, and they cannot restrict the meanings, other possible meanings, to this phrase. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. We will, God willing, start talking about the 74th verse in the next program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see. All the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Iran's fully indigenous Sahand frigate and Macron floating base are back in the Persian Gulf after more than 4 months of sailing that took them as far as the northern end of the Atlantic Ocean, over a distance of 44,000 kilometers. The naval crew were warmly welcomed by senior military officials who feel proud that Iran's navy is now capable of sailing in the high sea for extended periods.
We passed through three oceans, the Indian Ocean, the South Atlantic, and North Atlantic Ocean. On the way, we passed through rough seas and finally arrived in Russia's St. Petersburg port. We then sailed all the way back home. All the mission took us some 4.5 months. This is the farthest point we have ever sailed to.
Sahand Frigate is a radar-evading vessel that's equipped with torpedo launchers and electronic warfare technologies. And Macron Floating Base is a support vessel that's fitted with a large helicopter pad. Sahand and Macron departed from the Persian Gulf in early May. The two ships passed by Cape of Good Hope, rounded Africa, and sailed through the North Atlantic Ocean to reach Russia, all without docking for refueling on the way.
Throughout our journey, we did not stop to refuel or recharge our medical or food supplies. We went straight to our destination. We had our support vessel Macron along with Sahand that refueled it along the way. It sends a strong message to our enemies, especially the U.S., which tried to play down our naval might.
Iran's defense sector has been under 4 decades of U.S.-led arms embargoes. Iranian officials say they have viewed the sanctions as an opportunity to gain self-sufficiency in the industry. Iran now claims that it has indigenized more than 80% of its arsenal, from drones and helicopters to warships and submarines.
The Iranian Navy is back from the longest voyage in its history. To Iran, sailing through the Atlantic Ocean was a game-changer for two reasons. First, it shows that the country can rely on its domestically built equipment for tough naval missions amid U.S. arms embargoes. And most importantly, it adds Iran to the short list of countries with a blue water navy. Yusuf Jalali from the Persian Gulf.
Abu Ubaida, spokesman for the Izzeddin al-Qassam Brigades, the military wing of Hamas, pledged in a speech to release the prisoners who were rearrested after escaping from an Israeli jail on Monday. He also stressed that the rearrest of the prisoners does not hide the extent of shame Israel is going through, as Palestinian inmates have shaken their security system reputation.
No prisoner swap deal will be made without the release of our heroic prisoners who were rearrested by the occupation forces. We promise our inmates that they will be liberated soon within the no swap deal. Our inmates have exposed the fragility of the security of the enemy.
Immediately after Abu Ubaida's speech, Palestinian resistance fired rockets toward the occupied lands to show that they are ready to face the Israeli regime and defend Palestinians. In response, the Israeli airplane launched an airstrike on the Gaza Strip
The Palestinian resistance has achieved many goals. First, it succeeded in forcing the Israeli regime out of Gaza. Second, it demolished the Zionist thought of having this land for themselves. Israeli violations and attacks against Palestinians will never terrify us.
In conjunction with this, the resistance factions held a national conference stressing the importance of the resistance.
The clashes with this Israeli regime will persist. The regime can never feel secure as long as it steals our rights and kills our people. We will never leave our prisoners alone, and the resistance will set them free.
On Saturday evening, the rearrested prisoners appeared at the Israeli court in the city of Nazareth to extend their detention while being deprived of having a lawyer. Palestinians here stress on supporting the Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails and considering them the symbol of the Palestinian issue. Palestinian factions believe that the resistance is the only way to get their rights back. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Yemen's armed forces backed by local tribes have successfully conducted the third phase of Operation Nasr al-Mubin. The spokesman of the Yemeni army, Yahya Sariah, said Mahliya and the Rahabat directorates of Marib with an area of 1,200 square kilometers were fully liberated. The spokesman also said over 150 mercenaries loyal to the Saudi-led coalition were killed or injured during the operation.
The Yemeni unit succeeded in fully liberating the districts of Mahliya and Al Rafa during the third phase of Al Nasr al Mubin operation. During the operation, 151 mercenaries loyal to the Saudi-led coalition were killed or injured, and a total area of about 1,200 square kilometers were liberated.
Sariah also hailed the tribes of Marib for their role in supporting the Yemeni army in achieving the recent victory. Observers said the Yemeni army is now implementing the fourth phase of the Nasr al-Mubin operation aimed at fully liberating all the occupied territories of Yemen.
The third phase of the Nasr al-Mubin operation was a strong and important stage for the Yemeni army, which managed to liberate 1,200 Yemeni lands from the mercenaries loyal to the Saudi-led coalition. Military operations are still ongoing, and there is a fourth phase through which the Yemeni army seeks to liberate all of the northern Yemeni lands from all forms of foreign presence.
For months now, the Yemeni army has been intensifying its military operations to liberate the oil-rich province of Marib from the Saudi-backed forces and terrorist groups. This move was considered as the first step forward to expel foreign forces from the rest of the country.
Yemeni tribes have repeatedly announced their opposition to the presence of any foreign forces, especially those of Saudi Arabia. People here believe that the military will not be able to liberate the country without the backing of tribesmen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A big conference was held in the Gaza Strip on Sunday titled The Resistance Liberates and Oslo Destroys. Attendees demanded the cancellation of the so-called Oslo Peace Accord that was signed in 1993. In September of that year, the Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO, signed the Oslo Accord with the Israeli regime on the lawn of the White House in Washington, D.C. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas asserted the failure of the Oslo Accord and affirmed its adherence to armed resistance against the Israeli regime.
We assert that the shortest way to liberate all of Palestine and the prisoners is through the rifle and the resistance. Armed resistance is the one and only way to achieve the goals and aspirations of the Palestinian people.
The agreement was meant to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but years after signing the Oslo Accord, Palestinians consider it as a terrible chapter in their history.
The world must understand that the Israeli regime doesn't respect any international accords or agreements and only understands the language of force. The Oslo Accord has only brought pain and suffering and disasters to the Palestinians.
The conference comes almost 4 months after the Israeli military bombarded the besieged Gaza Strip for 11 consecutive days, killing at least 260 Palestinians, including 66 children. The Gaza-based resistance groups, mainly Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, also fired some 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war.
The Oslo Accord caused the Palestinian rift, while the armed resistance has managed to achieve several victories against the Zionist enemy. The Palestinians are fully backing the resistance, especially after realizing that the Zionist enemy was the only one who benefited from the Oslo Accord.
In its final communique, the conference announced that the Oslo Accord has been a major setback for Palestinians and is even worse than the Balfour Declaration of 1917, which helped create the Israeli regime on occupied Palestinian land. Palestinian resistance factions say that the futile Oslo Accords will not free Palestine and Al-Quds. They maintain that armed resistance is the key to freedom. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
On Saturday, in the Italian capital, hundreds of people staged a protest against the mandatory anti-COVID green pass, which came into effect on August 6 and whose effects are set to be further extended. The Italian government is planning to make the so-called vaccine passport a requirement for employees at all public sector workplaces, as well as potentially at key businesses in the private sector, including supermarkets. At the rally, protesters were holding banners which read "United for Freedom of Choice" and "Hands off our children."
Non discriminare, lasciare.
We are against all discriminations. People should be free to choose what's best for them, as stated in our constitution. Let me make clear that we are not against the vaccine.
Concerto di passaporto vaccinale.
Imposing a vaccine passport is nonsense. It's tantamount to blackmailing people. Furthermore, vaccines are still experimental and there are many unknowns about their effects.
The vaccine passport has been required since early August in order to access cultural and leisure venues across Italy. From September the 1st, the health certification has become obligatory for long-distance trains, domestic air flights and schools amid widespread grumblings.
Freevax protests held across Italy over the past weeks have often turned nasty. A few days ago, the police staged raids in several Italian cities against anti-vax extremists, during which weapons such as knives and clubs were found.
Le azioni sicuramente ledono.
These episodes have certainly affected our campaign. Let me add, however, that the media have purposely emphasized isolated incidents with the sole aim to criminalize all forms of dissent. So far, after weeks of protests, 8 people only have been put in custody by the police.
Anti-COVID Green Pass protesters at Saturday's rally in Rome were joined by supporters of far-right party Forza Nuova. An anti-vaccine passport protest was also held in Milan, with about 5,000 people parading in the city centre. Max Civili, Rome.
Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, has made a day-long visit to Tehran. During his short visit, he met with the new head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami. The Iranian official hailed the constructive talks he held with the head of the IAEA, Rafael Grossi, in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Speaking at a joint press conference after the meeting, Islami described the negotiations, mainly on technical issues, as constructive and said confidence building is what matters for Tehran and the UN nuclear watchdog.
Today, Mr. Grossi came to Tehran at the invitation of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, and we had good and constructive talks. The negotiations were held in a spirit of cooperation to create opportunities for enhanced interactions within the framework of the International Atomic Energy Agency's rules and regulations. Mr. Grossi will visit Tehran again in the near future, and the IAEA's technical team will also come to Iran to make necessary arrangements for the replacement of surveillance camera memory cards in accordance with the safeguards agreement.
But I'm glad to say that today we were able to have a very concrete result, which has to do with the continuity of the operation of the agencies equipment here, which is indispensable for us to provide the necessary guarantees and the information to the IAEA and to the world that everything is in order and that we are going to be able to assist, also to assist Iran in its future negotiations in the context of the JCPOA.
Back in February, Iran and the IAEA reached a technical understanding under which Tehran agreed to keep the camera recordings from its nuclear sites for 3 months as a goodwill gesture in support of diplomacy, waiting to see whether the other parties to the JCPOA could manage to bring the U.S. back into full compliance with the deal. The agreements came shortly after Iran decided to stop its voluntary implementation of the additional protocol that allowed the IAEA to carry out short-notice inspections in Iran, denying the agency's inspectors access to the country's nuclear facilities beyond the safeguards agreement. The decision was made in accordance with the December 2020 law passed by the Iranian parliament, dubbed a strategic action plan to counter sanctions that prompted the Iranian administration to restrict the IAEA's inspections and accelerate the development of the country's nuclear program beyond the limits set by the JCPOA. Iranian officials have cautioned the IAEA Board of Governors to avoid miscalculations at its upcoming meeting, warning that taking advantage of the IAEA for political purposes will draw a different response from Tehran. Saman Kujiri, Tehran.
Footage shocked the entire world back in September 11, 2001. Soon after the attacks, Al-Qaeda claimed responsibility and named it a victory. Al-Qaeda's move paved the way for the U.S. to invade Afghanistan in almost 1 month after the 9/11 attacks, following Taliban's refusal to hand over Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden to Washington. Since then, Bush administration declared the so-called war on terror and promised to eliminate terrorism in Afghanistan, bring peace to the war-ravaged country, and establish political and economic stability, all under a U.S.-backed governance system. But 20 years later, the Taliban, who are now in charge of the control of entire Afghanistan, excluding some mountainous areas in Panjshir province, say they had already warned the U.S. of being defeated by Afghans at any cost.
We had already warned the U.S. of the consequences of invading our country when the 2001 incident happened. But unfortunately, the Bush administration arrogantly invaded our homeland. Today, even its successors have not managed to take full control of our country. The U.S. invasion ended up in failure.
Apart from issues such as establishing a strong governance system in Afghanistan or leading Afghanistan to development, the return of Taliban to power has proved that the U.S. was not able to defeat this already ousted group.
Now, the Islamic Emirate is ruling over the country after 20 years of fighting against the U.S. This is among main signs of the U.S. defeat in its so-called war on terror in Afghanistan over the past 20 years.
The U.S. war in Afghanistan costed billions of dollars for Washington. According to President Joe Biden, the U.S. has spent $300 million each day during its 20 years of presence in Afghanistan, with 140,000 U.S. and Afghan military and civilians, including women and children, losing their lives in the Washington's longest war in Afghanistan. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
EU finance ministers wrapped up 3 days of talks. They say fewer bankruptcies have been recorded in the 27-country bloc than had been forecast due to COVID-19. However, current health trends are feeding economic uncertainty.
We have 13 countries seeing increasing case numbers and some countries also increasing number of deaths.
Eurozone inflation increased to 3% last month. That's higher than desired. The virus continues to have an impact.
There are still more than 2 million fewer people employed than before the pandemic, especially among the younger and lower skilled.
We have been speaking to some of those affected.
It would be nice if it would be possible for the European Union to help each other and to find something that works for everyone.
It's difficult because we don't have a lot of opportunities in our country. I mean, the government doesn't
put, I mean, like jobs, student jobs, as we have here in Brussels?
We don't yet know the full story because millions continue to receive government support to keep their jobs. Economists claim personal and government debt in the EU is too big to calculate. This as EU authorities say they are monitoring new COVID-19 variants.
Like the Lambda one and more recently the Mu one. The Mu one being potentially more of concern because of the potential increased immune escape that it may show.
Not only are the World Health Organization and others accusing the EU, US and UK of hoarding vaccines, critics say Western sanctions are hampering the efforts of foreign nations to deal with COVID-19. They say badly impacted places include Iran, Venezuela, Syria, Yemen, and Palestinian territories. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Israeli arms firms with special relationships to Britain might seek to profiteer from a possible new refugee crisis following the West's chaotic retreat from Afghanistan. This was the warning issued by co-founders of the UK-based Palestine Action Group, who have long fought to shut down the UK branches of Elbit Systems, a notorious Israeli weapons manufacturer.
We've seen what's happened recently as well with, I think it was 800 people who entered this country, and there's talks of, you know, taking them back, etc., but or stopping them from coming here in the first place. This is the technology that they will be using to try and stop people from seeking safety after many of these people have gone through war, have seen their communities destroyed, so companies like Elbit can profit.
Debates over the UK's commitment to refugees and treatment of illegal entry to the UK has resurfaced in recent weeks, with the government introducing stricter measures to halt illegal channel crossings of desperate refugees fleeing war zones. In past years, Britain has already purchased Israeli-built drone technology to track illegal entry attempts, with further purchases on the horizon.
It's been battle-tested, proven how it works in Gaza. So the same technology which is used to harass and surveil Palestinians. The UK are not only hosting Elbit sites to produce these drones, but they're actually making contracts to buy these very same drones in order to surveil the channel to stop migrants and refugees from seeking safety in this country. If you see someone about to be hurt, most people would step in the way. And that applies when we know that these weapons being produced here will be used to kill other people who, in a lot of circumstances, are powerless to what that weapon can do.
Both France and the United Nations have expressed grave concern at the UK's new tactics, which they feel could lead to many needless drownings in the English Channel, while Israel's arms industry is providing Britain the tools it needs in order to hunt down these vulnerable vessels. That's just another reason why Palestine Action feels so determined to see Elbit shut down. Robert Carter, Leicester.
After some 13 months of a deadlock in the country and a descending multifaceted crisis, Lebanon saw the birth of a new cabinet, led by Najib Miqati. Miqati stressed that he will do everything in his power to stop Lebanon's collapse.
The situation is difficult but not impossible to deal with if we cooperate together as Lebanese. We need to work hand in hand. Today, the president and I work on forming this cabinet, and it is not perfect, but only God is perfect. I can assure you that we are a team and we will work as one until we stop all the despair. I will leave at nothing to contact all international organizations to try to provide the minimum of good living and at least stop the collapse.
Lebanon's new prime minister urged the political groups to cooperate and give this government confidence to work as a team. President Michel Aoun told reporters off camera that the new government will begin addressing the concerns of the Lebanese, adding that Lebanon will get out of hell and rise from the abyss. A lineup of 24 ministers was announced on Friday from the Lebanese presidential palace.
The challenges this cabinet faces are economic, financial, monetary, and social. Therefore, it needs to hurry in putting together a salvation plan. This plan should include short-term